This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
In 1988, I organized an exhibition of Samuel Beckett's media work, one film called Film, starring Buster Keaton, and the series of works he made, or a selection of the works he had made for broadcast TV. Beckett had made works for American, English, German, and French TV stations, and I made a selection of those were included in this exhibition that toured for about 3 years. It was at the Jeu de Paume in Paris, it was at Exodart in New York City, the Australian Center for Photography, as well as other venues in Canada and the U.S. This was, in a way, done for my own self-interest. I was a young artist. I was fascinated by Beckett's work, and I'd never really seen a good production of this work. So I figured if I was able to see the work he was involved in producing himself, I could get an idea of what that was. Now, a lot of the work was done, in a way, in the idiom of the local station that was producing it. The TV, the American ones, often had the look of like early 1960s theatrical broadcasts, live TV broadcasts. This would be, well, Film is kind of shot that way, as well as A Joe. The ones in England were more influenced by his work in Germany when he did the version of A Joe there, Hey Joe, from the 70s, that had a more abstract look, like things were... the bed was a box painted gray with the pillow was another just a very simple sack and the basically an unlivable object or the room the characters were in. These were Ghost Trio, Nocturne, no wait, Ghost Trio, But the Clouds, Ghost Trio, But the Clouds, and Nocturne, I believe. Okay. The final ones were from his collaboration with Süddeutscher Rundfunk in Stuttgart. He'd done a number of films there since the 60s, and some of his last works were done with the same cinematographer that was his collaborator, that last one being Vos Vo. Anyway, from doing this project, I gained a reputation among Beckett scholars because no one had done this before, and we had assembled one of the first complete videographies of Beckett's work. So when the Pompidou Center in 2007 was doing an exhibition about Samuel Beckett to celebrate the centenary of his birth a year late, they invited me to do a project. So that's where this work came out of. Now when I was in Berlin at the time, being invited to do this, and the curators were coming. We planned to meet at a restaurant, but I had no idea what I was going to do. So it was kind of like hanging around the apartment, waiting for that moment, and looking at, looking for inspiration. For some reason, my eye glanced upon a copy of Kafka's Trial that was in the apartment I was staying in, and then a whole series of associations came up based on that. The primary one being my recollection, which was incorrect, that Orson Welles had shot his 1962 version of the trial entirely in Paris. It was partly shot in Paris, in the abandoned Gare d'Orsay, but what I thought were the Parisian suburbs that he depicted were actually in Yugoslavia, and certain other parts were done in Croatia, etc. Anyway, this was 2006, so the memory of the uprisings that had taken place in Paris was still fresh in my mind. So in a way, all these things are intertwined in this little knot that I've made, including the fact that one of the main locations you see in this piece is in La Courneuve, one of the places where some of the most extreme violence took place. And by coincidence, I didn't realize until later, was the building where Jean-Luc Godard shot two or three things I know about her. So in a way, if I were pitching this to Hollywood, I'd say this is Orson Welles meets Samuel Beckett at Jean-Luc Godard's place, which is all these things going to get all put together. Anyway, in 2005, on October 27, 2005, a number of kids were thought they were being pursued by the police. They ran into a power station, and for reasons that are still in dispute, two of them were killed by electrocution, another one severely injured, and the police were blamed for this, whether or not they actually did that. The fact is that the kids were playing football. Their story is they're playing football, they saw a police patrol coming, and they expected the usual, which was to be asked for their papers, to be harassed by the police, and possibly go downtown for a two-hour interrogation, which is they didn't want to do. So they ran from the police. So even if the police did not exactly kill the children or the teenagers, the general conditions of this kind of interrogation and harassment, that people living in these suburbs was the cause of that situation. So for the first night, there was, I think, one person died, 240 cars were burned, but in the riots that took place around Clichy-sous-Bois. But very soon, throughout the rest of the month and beginning of November, these riots spread throughout France. Until November 3rd, when you had the president of Jacques Chirac declaring a state of emergency, which would last for 3 months. As many of the North African people who were living in these housing projects, ringing the mains of the cities, were, in a way, destroying their living environments in protest of their living conditions in kind of an ironic way. So the funny connection between this being shot in the building, which has... It tells the stories of the trial. We have the character K, who's being pursued for unknown reasons, ambiguous reasons, being charged with a crime that she doesn't believe she committed. Somehow connects with the Beckett's image of a character who we never see until the very end. In Beckett's film, a character played by Buster Keaton called Object is pursued by the camera, called in the script I, who is a pursuing character who he's always trying to avoid, always moving away to keep his face from being seen. Even though this Keaton's got one of the most amazing faces in cinema, in Beckett's film, the whole gag is to avoid seeing his face to the very end. When it's finally confronted, the camera turns out to be Buster Keaton himself, so they confront each other. And with the third sort of cinematic illusion in this work, the ironic thing is that in Godard's film, a working-class woman begins turning tricks to sort of make ends meet, living in these new workers' complex on the outskirts of Paris. But now all these projects are not being occupied by the French or white working class, but by majority of people being North Africans.
Yeah, you already said that the choice of this building, La Courneuve, was not just one, as now I assume from your story, not just one modernist building, and it was not just about some kind of portrait of a generally modernist, abstract society, but a very specific one.
A lot of the other projects, we did a tour of all the housing projects around Paris, and this one had, in a way, retained its original features in a better fashion. It was, it was better shaped than most, and they hadn't tried too much to, have murals to sort of soften the edges of this thing. It was kind of left the way it was. Actually, it was fairly well maintained. This was the northern tower of a complex, and the southern tower was quite run down, quite ramshackle, actually partially abandoned. They're moving people out, and in a way, that was a point of contention in the area. In fact, it was quite tense the whole time we were there because, the riots were still in the back of people's minds. And we'd made deals with the local gangs that we could teach there. Well, first we talked to the mayor of La Courneuve. We talked to the manager of the building. We talked to the local drug dealers and gangs to make sure it would be okay. We hired a few of them for security. So that was all cool. But then the Ministry of Interior, then run by Sarkozy, got wind of our production and didn't want to have any kind of film production taking place in the suburbs for worry that there might be some kind of outbreak. So first we were denied access to La Courneuve, and then we went from suburb to suburb, and before we got there, we were told by the police that, no, you can't shoot here. We've heard about you. We know who you are. No, you can't do this. Forget it. Finally, we made a deal that we would shoot at between 4 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning and wrap every day. We had to wrap before then while the people were supposed to be asleep. But it was all part of the paranoia of the general administration at the time for more things to take place, because in a way those issues that had been the cause of the 2005 demonstrations were still there.
Mm. So you brought yourself and your team into the same situation that the youth living in that banlieue were in when they were running away. More or less. Sarkozy was at that time infamous for the quote that he said, these banlieues should be Karschaft, that there's some kind of method of I think, cleaning houses with a sand...
Sandblast?
Yes. So that was basically his that his statement to the response to the social unrest was, it should be sandblasted away.
Yeah, his metaphors tended to be about, you know, these people were scum, they were garbage, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, with your Ministry of the Interior identifying you as such, you know, you're not very, you don't feel very welcome in your culture.
Yeah. But still, then, on the other hand, the Beckett is a completely, not, let's say, not different, but Beckett as well as Kafka both belong to a tradition of an investigation of the modern condition, which is at the first glance not political at all, or avoids any relation to specific events.
Yeah, that's correct, sir.
Yeah, but so what was the idea to bring them together, or to?
In a way, my Beckett was kind of different from the general perception of Beckett. I always felt that there was a at least epistemological quality to the work that would necessarily have social implications. Mm. You know, it has to do with certain basic problems of subjectivity, basic problems of intersubjectivity, and, you know, of identifying truth or not. These are things which are, in a way, always stumbling blocks, always impossibilities, but in a way I think it's Beckett not being the end of something, but rather the beginning of something. It's like the sort of the zero point from which we have to, you know, claw ourselves out of. It's not a question of failure. Mm. It's like there's that idea, you know, I can't go on, I'll go on, or, you know, try and fail, try again, fail better. That's kind of the Beckettian gestures. You do it again, but you do it better, you get closer to that ideal, even though you know you can never possibly get there. Mm. So that kind of, you know, will is a feature that I kind of identified in Beckett, primarily from looking at his later works, like works like Company or How It Is, his prose work more than his plays, which I thought was a very interesting way of working. In this case, it's the whole question of identity, like who is this person? Mm. We tell she's a black woman, we're pursuing a black woman, we presume a North African woman, which she was, but we never actually see her face, unlike the Beckett's film, where in the end there's a reveal of the face, and so the gag is he confronts himself, he's been running away from himself or something. In this case, we never really see it. So in the sense that the whole gesture of a self-identification, which is the character being identified with a camera and a look being identified with the camera and a character, that sort of a knot that makes up most of narrative cinema, and here is being denied to a certain degree. Just as her, you know, to a certain degree, her identity is being denied in a culture that depends entirely upon either assimilation, like either you become you become French, which is almost as intolerant as the idea of multiculturalism, which says, you know, you stay in your zone, or you become French. In this case, because there was no provision for how do you account for these differences, that these problems arose.
Just get back a little bit to Diedrich, what you were saying about Kafka and Beckett being apolitical. However, if one looks at their form at the time of their writing was considered quite sort of markedly strange, different, and one could even say certain politics of form in breaking with traditional novels or traditional dramatic structures. And form has been very important in all of your work, particularly with technological innovation. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit exactly how this was conceived to be shown. You mentioned a loop. Why a loop? What sort of, you know, the use of video? Why video? If you could talk a little bit about that and how it connects to the social.
There's a series of a series of tropes which are referring back to, in a way, my own work, but also the key references, which is Beckett and Wells's works. The surveillance camera you see at the beginning is an analogy to the eye that we see at the beginning and end of Beckett's film. There are certain shots which are almost identical to shots that are there. They kind of get interwoven in a certain way. If you look at it, you could walk in the middle of this work to a certain degree and imagine it to be a loop. It does resolve what the conflict is as you get partway through the story, but if you go maybe halfway in, you could imagine that the end and the beginning somehow connect to each other, in spite of the fact of this break with that first dot, the abstract dot, and the surveillance camera. All of which is shot with an HD camera, Sony F9, with the gain turned up to 18 dB. So the whole surface is punctuated by noise. It's like a sort of sparkling surface. So you're kind of seeing the CCD, you're seeing the video seeing, or seeing the media of how it produces images interfering with the images you're trying to see. So that's part of the whole structure of the piece. It's shown as an installation in a large room on a gray screen, HD resolution projector. So this, even though it's like very, very big, very crisp, there's still this interference of the texture of the thing you're looking through that doesn't help let you see through it.
I was just also in response to no. I mean, there is of course a long tradition in political investments in both Kafka and Beckett, for a while it was Kafka was kind of the indicator of how are relations between kind of socialist governments versus another way of. Let's say, in their language, formalist criticism of capitalism, or were they not accepting it at all? There was a time when literary scholars were looking at how was Kafka received or discussed in Eastern European, during Cold War time, Eastern European symposia, in order to find out what would be the politics on literature. And, of course, in Beckett, there was all this investment from people up to Adorno, who saw in his work a kind of in the last instance critique of aporias of capitalist modernity. But all these people who did this investment, they always went that way that they bought into the abstraction in Beckett. They bought into the means of making things unspecific. And making them into and buying into the markers of human condition or things like that, in order then to translate that into a critique of culture. Yeah. Whereas what you're doing is, I think, in this film, a little bit the opposite. You're confronting this analysis with something very specific, not only the building or the what you were saying about the specific time period in which you were shooting it, but also like if you look at her, and the only thing that we know about her. You said you assume she's a black woman, you assume she's North African, but what we constantly specifically see is that she makes a certain fashion statement with her hair, which is really very specific. Yeah. And so that is the thing that I really find very interesting about this way of dealing with Beckett. And I would have a question that would go from there maybe to another issue. You were saying Beckett, you were describing Beckett as some kind of degree zero of research into subject formation or something like that.
Sounds good.
if we assume that would be a viable description. You have done a lot of kind of research and you worked a lot with unmarked structures of television. You've done a lot of reference to television production, and you thematized the not so thematic aspects of it, the way it is made, the on the level of the media, on the level of montage, on the level of all those things that we normally don't see explicitly,
yeah.
And so that would be again some kind of a research into subject formation, I would say. But in a completely different way. Now, Beckett did the same. He had, he had an interest in television as well. Is there a connection or?
Very much so. I mean, in a way, I did that exhibition. I knew I was influenced by Beckett, that I would be influenced by Beckett. And in a way, I was like going to cut short anybody saying, hey, you're influenced by Beckett. I was saying, I know. By doing this exhibition, I'm sort of laying out what I know about what will be. Sort of structure my work for a number of years. There's certain ways in which he uses the basic technical features of video or TV at that point that is integral to the way in which the work works. In Ajo, it's very, actually precedes wavelength by a few years. I believe, but you have basically a very slow zoom into the face of this one character. He doesn't say a word, but we hear a voiceover, presumably a voice of a woman who killed herself because of this man, as he zooms in and we're sort of imagining his intensifying guilt. And it's just basically one technical gesture of the camera takes place for the entire thing, which he lays out quite clearly. In Ghost Trio, he lays out three modes of narrativity. First, just describing, it's almost like the new novel, like a Rope Grey thing, where it describes the things in the space and dispositions of the characters and their objects. Later going through a voiceover narrative as action takes place, and finally with an unnarrated sequence of more traditional montage as the character goes through his motions of thinking that he hears his beloved appearing, which I believe is the sort of central trope of that piece. That plus the idea of repetition and difference, like the idea of repeating the same situation and doing it again, is something that's been quite influential in my work, especially in my later, what I call my recombinant pieces, my work of this century, which has been a number of film works which change over time. They have using basic narrative chunks, which then reassemble into new narrative formations, which make a work that no two people can see exactly, because you walk in at one time, you leave at a different time, you have a different experience of the work, which we always do, but this happens in a more extreme degree. And the funny thing is, with this work, even though it basically just loops and that's all it does, people would often describe to me the amazing sort of subtle variations I put into the shots, because they're expecting my stuff to have those variations, but they've only just had a different quality of attention as they watch the thing loop over and over again.
Yeah, so that this other piece was kind of an allegory of an aesthetic experience, whereas the others actually produced this aesthetic experience that is never the same. And Beckett as a playwright is kind of one of those playwrights that get fewer and fewer and probably don't even exist anymore, who is very who's not thinking of him as writing a script that is open to interpretation for a director, but is really trying to in most of the productions he could get his hands on and try to influence the production a lot. And I was never sure. I mean, I'm not such a Beckett expert, but I'm never sure if his interest in TV had to do with that as a way of being able to really finish the scenic work, really finish the theater work, or if it was also what was also somehow suggested in the way you referred to it. He was interested in TV as a machine, as a medium that produces exactly the conditions he's talking about.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it could almost be like Glenn Gould, who wants to produce a perfect performance by recording and editing and doing it a certain way. Mm-hmm. Perhaps by virtue of using this recording technology, he can produce the precise temporal apparatus he wants to make within that particular work. But I actually prefer Beckett in reverse. I like the earlier Beckett theatrical staging to the late Beckett, mm-hmm. this kind of extreme abstraction that you get with the later works, which in a way almost confirm that prejudice that I'm kind of talking against. Whereas the earlier works could be done by almost anybody in a very interesting way. Mm-hmm. Like one of the best productions I saw the only one I saw live was of Godot, done by it's like John Turturro, Tony Shalhoub, and Christopher Lloyd. So all these comedians doing this thing, which is it was perfect. And an early recorded one I saw, which was like Zura Mostel and other like Broadway comedians, and it was like they didn't treat it seriously, they treated it like a comedy, which had to work as a performance, and it worked perfectly. I'm kind of more for this being treated like a script, and it's like the mandate that you say, but yeah, that's absolutely what happened later in his career, where he wanted to have strict control to make the script dictate exactly how the work would be seen.
You had this after you had decided to have this very specific image of architecture in the beginning, and the very specific fashion statement in this otherwise anonymous character. The other characters in that film, how were they casted? Because I was thinking that how, especially in other films that refer to Kafka, yeah, people try to get some kind of look of the eternal bureaucrat, the kind of abstraction of a bureaucrat. Whereas you know, there's not an example right now, yeah, but they seem to be, I think, at least very specific for the in relation to the function that they have. Whether they are the ones who take care by their arms and more like the executive, or those who are in the courtroom that we haven't seen so far.
Yeah.
How was that going on, that casting? And were they all coming from France? Were these French actors, or,
oh, yeah,
or did you bring some of them?
Oh, they're all French actors, sadly. I mean, I was kind of confused because a lot of the when they do films, they improvise a lot. I wasn't aware of that. My French isn't super, and so when I was directing in French, and when they began improvising on my script, it was like, "What are you doing? You know, where are things going?" But in a way, they're mostly types. I mean, we have like the cops are cop types. Mm-hmm. The lawyer is a bit different, actually. The women are slightly different, but Aisha, who's playing Kay, is kind of out of time. She's different from the rest, mm-hmm, even though there are certain time periods that are imminent to the mise-en-scene that we have here, the 60s in the housing project, and most of the administrative buildings that we see her being subjected to are like 30s sort of fascist buildings in downtown Paris, mm-hmm, university and a hospital that we use for locations.
But there is this woman that she has this single face-to-face conversation with,
yeah,
and she's obviously something like a character. You get seduced or into thinking that something's going to happen with her.
Yeah.
She's not like the others. She's not just a function, not just a type. So who was she, or what was?
Well, she was a lawyer. She was an advocate of some kind. This is replacing the character that Orson Welles himself plays in the trial. So I just wanted to be a character with that kind of charisma when you see them on screen, and I think she's got that. She's an amazing actress. Her name escapes me right now, but yeah, it's that, the sort of, in a way, a little bit of a narrative peek in the thing. We think something might happen. There might be an answer, but then, of course, nothing, because she wants to know, Kay wants to know more than she could ever possibly get.
About the...
Which are actually photographs. We do actually see her face. Because after she sees the lawyer, she gets her file, which has images of her, surveillance images of her, which if you look carefully, you can't actually see her face in those images.
The topic of surveillance has come up several times, as well as police riots, and it's appearing in some of your work from 2008. I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about that?
About the mural?
Well, about the mural, okay. Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, or just the, yep, interest in surveillance as a form, and basically the riot also as this kind of event, because it seems that riots are coming up, demonstrations, quite frequently now.
Yeah, I mean, crowds appear in a series of works I made around 2008 called Crowds and Riots. They're all an ensemble which are have a focal point being a depiction of a riot that took place in Vancouver in 1971, which amazingly is a 25 by 40 foot mural on glass in the location where it took place, where the police had been beating up hippies who felt their civil rights were being abused by not being allowed to smoke marijuana in the places they were squatting in downtown Vancouver. And so the police came down very heavily on this by smashing heads and part of the problem is they're just disorganized, the police force. So anyway, I made this public artwork, which is a monument to this event, which was thankfully through a private developer, because probably if it was like a civic project, I would have been shut down. I was like waiting for it at any moment to be shut down by some bureaucrat telling me I couldn't do this. When in fact, the day before shooting, the chief of police called my studio and said, "You know, we've been trying to live this down for 30 years. How dare you resurrect this moment by making a mural of it? I want you to come to my office." And I didn't do that because, you know, that's inappropriate of him to do that. But in a way, I mean, a lot of these works are, I guess, since a lot from this, the last 10 years or so, have had this idea of policing as being a central feature in Inconsolable Memories, which is a piece about Cuba, about the Mariel boatlift, et cetera. It all kind of centers around a guy being arrested and then possibly being allowed to go back to the, or leave to go to the U.S., but he escapes with the Marielitos and comes back to Cuba. Or Klatsassen, which is a Western set during the Gold Rush, based on Rashomon by Kurosawa, in which there's a number of trials that take place in the wilderness. This piece, so I think in a way, less surveillance than it is policing, and how does our state decide to enforce, what is or is not common law, and how can this be abused or abided by? These kind of take place. And the crowds, those photographic works were more working with the problem of how do you make a multivalent or a dialogical picture that is not just about one thing, but about multiple things. And so I just try to condense time and space by having more and more people having different reactions to it, to similar atmosphere or event that's taking place, which happens in a series of photographs about the free speech demonstrations in 1925 in Vancouver, when Wobblies tried to organize unemployed men and free speech was banned in Vancouver. The 1935 Battle of Valentine Pier, when four levels of police were breaking up one of the first unions who were protesting their jobs being taken away. A crowd at a racetrack in 1955 who were made into a group, but in a way unaware, a group of spectators waiting for the horse races so they can make or lose some money, and finding this riot. So different kinds of a group subject being formed by these different crowds was the general tendency in these things.
But the diagnosis of this piece on the condition in living in La Courneuve or in under the conditions of 2005, at times that one even can think it's some kind of translation into an older narrative by where you still have the forces of policing present in forms of people who actually fulfill all those functions, all these people who really wear these coats and they grab you by the hand and they finally they execute you. Or that this kind of it isn't, as opposed to all these kind of invisible borders, electronically enforced segregations, and so on. Was that some kind of attempt to construct a continuity of these different types of policing between what's going on right, what went on right then in La Courneuve, and these kind of 60s, 50s ideas of a total society or a totalitarian society?
Yeah. Well, I think it was actually, it was quite personal, I think, the contact between the police and the youths in the Parisian suburbs. It was this sort of, they were terrorizing people by going out there and making themselves known, showing that they can demonstrate force whenever they want, as they like, pick up anybody they want whenever they like, ask for their papers whenever they like, and this might be a snowball into something else. So this kind of terror was a very personal thing that was actually acted out by people. Mm-hmm. Certainly, kinds of surveillance are more subtle and sophisticated in the world we live in now. Facebook is basically a huge system of surveillance where people free to give information about themselves that is then sold to people as general activities, and they're kind of unaware of that, or I don't know why people do Facebook, but that's this kind of surveillance is pretty extraordinary and pretty invisible. But this is a it's a moving picture, and I wanted to show things that I could show. I think the kind of policing was physical and personal, so these guys are there, but also play with this idea of anachronism too. Like the surveillance camera we made is like we've made this thing that looks like no real surveillance camera, but it's got this sort of funny 70s look. It doesn't really oscillate. There's a guy in the back with an electric motor making the thing go back and forth. It, didn't really exist, but it had a certain timelessness to it, or sort of out of timeness to it, the kind of thing that could have happened, been made in the 60s and still is being used now, just like we still have those 30s buildings that are still in use, or those 60s buildings still in use in different forms. So these different regimes of surveillance or panopticons are still sort of around. Like the authoritative subject that builds these fascist buildings is, you know, makes the people feel small in them. The bureaucratic imagination that wants to warehouse the working class into these towers, you know, that is sort of in the architecture. You know, all these things are part of the whole mise en scène.
You've used in some of your other works, I mean, sound plays a really important role. And I was very struck by the silence in this piece until the end.
Yeah.
Can you just sort of talk about that decision to film in silence and why?
Well, a lot of my works has got way too much talk because the scripts are often very elaborate, and a lot of the, say, narrative variation is based on that. But I've always been kind of irritated by this idea of the prominence of the voice or psychologism in films, and, you know, can just be a visual medium. You know, in this, I didn't have to write a script. They had to have something to say when they worked together or performed together. So I had to write some things out, but... in a way, it's more about, and if you actually can lip read, everything does make sense in French. But you know, I want to see if I could make a story without that that crutch of psychobabble.
Mm. But it's also, I think, if it would have been, if it's so much about suggestion of, I mean, this is the whole idea of. The trial is suggesting cruelties and torture and so if it's all about the suggestive, it I think sound would have then felt like felt strange, felt it would then be horror sound and that would have ruined it, I think.
And the story is so, I mean, it's so relentlessly linear. You don't really need any talk at all. It's just it can tell its story quite well without any sound whatsoever. Although there's music as well, which appears now and then in the sort of places in between, which are all variations on a song by Chic called "Everybody Dance," because Wells uses the Albione Adagio, which is a sort of very Albione's Adagio, which is sort of gushy, you know, sort of sentimental piece of music. Yeah. I thought it would have been a more post-war version of that, and so I thought disco would be a good example of a thing where you sort of like get rid of your anxieties and that kind of thing.
But also instrumental without lyrics. You don't hear lyrics.
It's instrumental, yes.
I didn't even recognize. I thought it was just generic funkiness. It was just not.
Well, if you're a few, you can probably make out the chord changes or the melodies. There's one that's very close. But that was like John Medeski and Melvin Gibbs and Scott Harding was producer and guitarist. Drummer's name I forget right now.
Yeah, they were much more musician-like, mechanic as Chic sometimes sounds.
Right.
Not this kind of super polished perfection.
Yeah, they're different. There are like six variations, are all a bit different. Some sound like more like a cop show. Mm. Some sound more like a disco song. Some sound more like a funky song, that kind of thing. Different takes on the same melodic kernel. I mean, in terms of temporality, there never really is an exact temporality. If you look at the, say, clothing in the 70s, like when I was staging that riot mural, I couldn't do everything like it was the 70s because there were people still dressing like it was the 40s. Like the old guys kind of dress like the 40s. There's kind of greaseball types who dress like the 60s or 50s. That was still sort of in play. And just as these buildings still stand in these neighborhoods in and around Paris, the administrative imagination that placed them there in the first place is obviously embedded in the built in the architecture, but also still present in the administration that keeps the different class stratifications in Paris as they are. So looking at within the system of the work itself, you're looking at a number of different temporal regimes which are all present simultaneously. And in a way, K is the one character of our time. Everything else is kind of out of time, still relics of that past moment, which are still still sort of floating around. But in terms of Kafka and Beckett, I guess it's probably more like Wells and Beckett, because I was less interested in Kafka himself than it was Wells's use of Kafka in the moment he was doing that. So he was depicting these housing projects as a generic post-war reconstruction architecture, which we have in North America, as well as what was happening in Europe. And he was depicting these things as basically warehouses for the working class. And that's what they were brand new when Wells made them, and when Godard made his film. And now they're somewhat decrepit in the moment I was making my film. With Beckett himself, I don't know if I'm exactly that specifically engaged in his response to the kind of regimes that are surrounding when he made those things. I have to admit that I was really more concerned with the visual gag of having a main character who we never see. We never see up close. I guess cultural formations were appearing at that moment in response to those problems. I'm suggesting that these problems have not entirely gone away, or they persist even in the symptomatic response to that moment.
I thought if one reads the main character, the K character, as the sentence, in Paris today, there are many people living still or again as in a Kafka-esque situation, that can be hold for a while, and then all of a sudden, like you said, that you enter other historical moments. But one can still read it like this, because it's like the how in the as in Kafka's times. This grammatical function is, if you see these people who line up in the staircase, they're obviously not from the present, but in order to say people living today like the in the banlieue, they are forced to live in a way other people were forced to live in whatever the 30s in Austria or in Germany, then this is set by showing them. So they meet as you meet in a sentence. And that I thought was, when I asked you before about the continuity thing, that this produced the continuity. But I must say, I was also kind of confused about the 7-inch singles, because where did they come? They're not either in Orson Welles nor in Beckett.
Sorry, the music you mean?
The 7-inch singles.
Oh, 7-inch singles.
That are obviously in her apartment.
Right.
I couldn't make it. They didn't rhyme for me.
Okay.
Although they're beautiful, but.
Well, people said, people in. Who knows when this is really set? This is set now. It is to a certain degree, but also it is kind of set in the 60s or 70s.
But hairstyle is...
Yeah, I know. It's out of time. Time's out of joint in this thing. there was actually something with the records. I forget it now. It's actually if you can read the labels, there is something about the records that is kind of specific. I forget what that was now.
There's also this card where she gets that she has to go to number 64 and to room 360-something.
Yeah.
There is something on the bottom of that card which looks somehow like old typography, like something from a, cloakroom.
Those still exist. You can still find printers who are doing like letterpress stuff or carte de visite, which look exactly like that today. People still get those made. That's, we just went to one that was still making the things of that in the old way. And
what does it say?
I can't remember now. Sorry.
And the destroying of the picture of the her file,
yeah.
That is something that is also you have also in the Beckett film. Is she picked up and led to her execution because she did that, or is that happening to her because she finally stepped into the public sphere, because she's finally in the open in what is kind of the deteriorated version of a plaza, and that is not to be tolerated.
I don't know. That's something I didn't actually decide what that really was. Like, is she just destroying government property, and that's why she's being taken away?
Mm-hmm.
That could be a good rationale for it. It could be, it's kind of a multivalent thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the Beckett original, he's tearing up images of himself, mm-hmm. Images of his past. Here she's tearing up the images of herself that were made by the administration.
Mm-hmm.
That's
she's revising the subject formation.
No, I'm just wondering why you said it's a woman as the protagonist.
I guess to mix it up. I mean, I was just always within the representation of that moment. It was always young men were the ones who were supposed to be the subjects of this moment and this kind of harassment, when women were often subject to it as well. And I just thought, why not make it a her instead of a him? Just, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I wonder if, in a way, not showing her face is a kind of ethical or political gesture for you, because the theme of the video is constant surveillance and power and control exerted through rendering everything visible.
Yeah. Exactly. It kind of closes. I mean, it would close that loop if we actually do see her face. Finally, oh, here's the answer to the problem, or one, I guess, desire that the film might produce, like the desire to see who she is and to see through her emotional response to the scenes in her face. To keep on withholding that kind of refers back to the fact that she cannot be represented. Yeah. I guess it's the organization of civic space that has grown over time in Paris, and that was and the policing of it which caused those riots to a certain degree, and those specific, I mean, to somebody who's French, and that's why I tried to sort of give a little description of what those conditions were around the time I made that. These conditions, just showing a suburb or this kind of architecture, evokes that condition immediately. So it is kind of grounded in our moment, but that that recognition was made possible by 30 or 40 years of the movement of the working class to the suburbs, and then eventually that changing complexion from white to North African. So all that, those layers are kind of visible, I think, to French audiences and people who are more or less familiar with those conditions there.
I mean, just looking at this again now, how much are you concerned with, I don't know, for lack of a better term, conventions of viewing, how people perceive, when I see when she's being led through the corridor first, it seems to be almost like a video graininess that reminds me of the newscaster. Then there's the red camera address, right, which marks what back to certain moments of reality TV. Now, how much are you concerned with, if any, of temporary mode of viewing that you may or may not connect to?
Like an association with reality TV, that kind of thing?
Or any of those. I mean, documentary film or what are the kind of tropes that you are coming to play?
I should be able to answer that, but I can't. So, I mean, things appear, things go. Often they're more cinematic, but there is, of course, the whole condition of the cinematic being transformed into video. And like the title of the piece is video. It begins with the image of a video camera. So in a way, many of these associations with video technology are there. The one that is closest to what you're saying is the one where it was the handheld shot following her through the corridor, which is quite different from everything else. If I had my druthers, I would have used a Steadicam or a dolly, but just couldn't work that out. But no, I can't answer your question adequately, sorry.
But then, I mean, the forms of penning and I thought they were referring to the historical points of reference. They were referring to they were the way cinema the forms of cinematic storytelling that you found either in film or in the trial.
Sure, I just can't give really specific examples as to what where they came from. You know, some things were based on. A lot of things, it was done on a fairly tight budget, and things are often based on the limitations of you know, what we can get there and get where. Sometimes I would have wanted different tools when I got there, but in North America, when you shoot a movie, you've got a truck outside that's got all the stuff, and you only pay for what you take out. But in France, you've got to decide exactly what you want, and if you haven't got what you need on location, you're kind of stuck with what you chose. So, but it is, you know, it's fairly straightforward. Cinematic camera work that we're seeing in this.
Yeah, but it's somehow related, I think, at certain points to the idea of the uncanny and, for example, the first time that she's in front of the mirror and the camera position moves to the left of her shoulder, this can be read at that moment as the presence of someone, of another eye in the room, and no longer just the objective eye of some objective storytelling camera. And then there's another scene where you, when after these two cops left for the first time, all of a sudden there are other rooms. There seem to be rooms in her apartment that seem to somehow open-ended and some of labyrinthine going somewhere, and you don't even know if not the this corridor she has to walk through is also somehow connected with her apartment in some kind of eraserhead way.
It's a very simple set, but we tried to give a sense that the shape of the interior of her apartment didn't agree with what was outside of it. That was one conscious decision. And certainly throughout there are many moments where I wanted to appear like the camera was pursuing her as an additional character that she's avoiding. Her first movement into the corridor to her apartment is definitely one of those. Just didn't like the handheld feel of the one in the labyrinth beneath the courthouse, but that is another one that was consciously made that way. Even the one where she tears out the photographs, it sort of lets her walk away from that. But it's like there is an absent one, as Bellure might say.
Actually, you don't see the face of the strangler until the person is arrested.
I think you kind of answered your own question. But I agree in a way that the two opposing things are, I mean, the eye of the surveillance camera we see at the beginning, and the eye of the of Kay who we never see, or her face, the thing that we usually use to identify with as the subjectivity of the main character. I mean, we're shown the camera, and then we see possibly through the camera, through the rest of the film, through this grainy image, which it's got that, I guess, formal quality of showing the cameras in the act of seeing, but also does resemble this grainy kind of footage. Yeah, I mean, to show you have high. We know certain situations in which things are shot by, and there's a technical way in which things are shot, which have certain meaning and context. In this context, the high gain image is when you want to see things in shadows with no natural light. So it's about seeing things that can't normally be seen. And that, in a way, the noise of high gain video signifies that. And that's kind of, plays her out. And everything was shot, it's not so clear in this standard def video, but everything was shot with this kind of, ambiguity between what is noise and what am I actually seeing. You know, especially in the big open shots, like with where they're destroying that building where she has the gun episode. Yeah, especially when she's in her apartment for the first time, where we lose track of her. Like, where is she? You know.
Any other comments, questions?
Yeah,
Jay.
It seems like this piece is in the process of maybe not quite narrating itself, but it's an open potential. It seems like there's no moment, arguably, that's more important than any other. And so I'm wondering if you chose images from this to represent your film when it was being publicized or presented, and if so, how did you choose an image or a series of images to represent this piece?
In the publicity for this talk, or
No.
Right, good
wherever
point.
It's been shown,
right?
How the publicity factor is not the important part, but just this idea of how do you select from a film where almost all things seem equal to represent the film in another way or another venue. I'm not sure. Did you choose images that go along with this as a way of letting people know what it is or what to expect?
If you were to distill it into slides,
right? No, you can't really distill these things into individual frames, but I would typically use the facade of the apartment building as the iconic image. You know, it's just like kind of tells a lot just by the view of that building. It tells a story about where it is, what kind of people live there, et cetera, et cetera.
And does that connect with this larger idea of translating Beckett?
Probably not, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just had this question about, I don't know if I misheard you, but you said something about the 70s and a cultural formation of a moment, or something because we were talking about temporality, so the way that it's really hard to place this in time, and there's like kind of little signals to different time periods that kind of, remind me kind of in a sideways way a little bit about, Isaac Julian uses the 70s. I don't know if those things are connected, but I don't know if I misheard you.
I guess I had kind of a fetish about the 70s. I mean, had a bit of a fetish about the 70s since 2001. And because it seemed like a moment where everything changed. Everything was like taking place after the Second World War. Decolonization, Bretton Woods, civil rights, youth movements, all these things took a different turn in the 70s. Certain kinds of opposition that were tolerated in the 60s were no longer tolerated. And certain ways of policing them became a lot more sophisticated that, as well. And the kind of confidence in a way, the U.S. dollar is kind of a gold standard within the economic system fell apart around 1973, 74, which had everybody scrambling to make a new situation, which resulted in globalization to a certain degree. So it seems to me there's a kernel event that took place in the 70s, this moment of recession and of certainty, after ones of where everything seemed to be possible, where the conditions we live in now have been to a certain degree determined. So this has been something I've been going back to again and again in a number of works, in Suspiria, in Journey to Fear. But in a way, I the only real 70s illusion is the music, and that's kind of just thrown in there as a conceit to sort of tie it back into my...
What year is that song from?
Oh, that would have been 78.
78, yeah. Okay. But I was thinking that in 2005, the Iraq war was a few years old, but when the war in Iraq started and the European allies were not all ready to yeah. Then the phrase was coined of old Europe. I think Rumsfeld said there's old Europe, and old Europe is not, so there's the new world order, so old Europe is not falling. Right. And so I was thinking during the film at one point, because many people then thought maybe old Europe is an alternative to the wrongness of the new world order. Hmm. And as if this film was saying, so you think old Europe is an alternative, then go back to old Europe. And I think this is somehow even put to a kind of a comic moment, and when you're in this courthouse, and when they are laughing about her, and something is said, and she says something, and everybody's laughing at her. It's so grotesque in that situation. It's so grotesque. It's so theatrical. It's such an old form of representation. And the entire atmosphere of surveillance and totalitarianism is interrupted and dimmed down to this kind of comfort in the comedian, in the comic, in the grotesque, and then you're all of a sudden back in the square, and so there's this seriousness again. So because there is a connection between the two, it's not separate. You can't escape to old Europe.
Yeah.
So that was the one reading that occurred to me, which I think was not where the film was not loop-like, and where not every element was equally important, but where there was some kind of an arch that was bringing this forward.
Yeah. She has a moment there too, where they do begin to laugh, and then she says something that shuts them up. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what that was, but there was something she says which shuts them up and makes them a bit embarrassed to have laughed when they did.
And why do they laugh in the first place? What happens before that? She also must have said something.
She said it was ridiculous within their mm-hmm. scheme of things. And so they sort of reaffirm their confidence in their bureaucracy by laughing, and mm-hmm. the person who doesn't understand how it works. Mm-hmm. But then she says something which makes them embarrassed, which kind of was a key moment for me as well.